welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. And once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way, even if they don't want to admit it. Today on the show, a huge episode from the band The Magnetic Fields. Claudia Gonson and Stephen Merritt are on the podcast. And this, buckle up, this is a good one. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and the show's producer and your guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left for Damian. This podcast is on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. I said Instagram, and there's probably something I'm forgetting, but all those are at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. And if you want to support the show, tell all your friends about this podcast. Let them know that there's this podcast, and you know what to say. You can also check out the band I play in. There's more information to be found at fuckedup.cc. We have a new record. I may have spoiled something there, but we got a reissue of David Comes to Life, which is out now. You can pick that up there. All sorts of stuff. Tour dates, I don't think we've announced any there. Oh, maybe, I don't know what I'm not supposed to talk about, what I'm supposed to talk about. So head over to fuckedup.cc, looking for gold.blogspot.com. And there's fucked up social media. I don't follow it, but there's fucked up social media you can follow too. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, Claudia and Stephen from The Magnetic Fields are on the show today. And when Tristan told me that The Magnetic Fields people were into coming on this podcast, I was stoked, but I was also kind of shocked. I didn't know there was a punk connection or anything like that at the time. I'm a huge fan of this band. If you do not know The Magnetic Fields, I do not know how to help you with that, because this is one of the most significant bands to kind of emerge from, I gotta pick my words very carefully, as you'll hear in a minute, from music in the last decades, few decades. Incredible songs right from the very beginning with this band. They are celebrating the anniversary of their classic, monstrously ambitious, but sticks the landing, 69 Love Songs. There's a silver anniversary, 25 years this thing has been out now. That's wild. I remember this thing coming out, picking it up, and just being blown away by this thing. Merge Records is going to be reissuing it as a 6 10-inch record set. It's going to be on silver vinyl. It looks awesome. This looks amazing. I'm going to pick this thing up. Order it now, it says, because it's moving fast. So order yourself a copy of this anniversary edition, the silver anniversary, I guess. 25 years of silver? I should probably know this thing. I think so. The Magnetic Fields are also going to be going on tour. A lot of these shows are selling out. So find your tickets now for them. You can head over to mergerecords.com and Magnetic Fields. Well, just go to mergerecords.com. You'll see the Magnetic Fields tab and you can click on it and get yourself some tickets to these shows before they all sell out. Stockholm, Toronto. I'm looking at the dates right now. Well, if you're in one of these cities, count yourself among the blessed that you get to see this thing. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. As you can tell, my voice is shredded. I'm up late podcasting, just living that life. I haven't even done a show or recorded in a long time. This is just voice stress from doing podcasts. Oh my gosh. Well, anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Stephen and Claudia on Turned Out of Punk. Claudia and Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
It is an honor to have you both here. You guys are a band I'm a huge fan of, the records you put out for years and years and years, but to my own ignorance, never placed you in the punk context until recently. And oh my gosh, do I have a lot of nerdy shit to get to.
Well, I think Distortion maybe is our post-punk album that actually makes sense to describe as in relation to punk. And ordinarily, we are not especially in relation to punk so much as we're in relation to Irving Berlin. So, we have our moments, but that's not how we identify particularly. I identify as a variety artist, and I don't know how Claudia identifies, but I expect she'll tell us.
How do I identify musically? Is that the
Yeah.
question?
What band do you think you're in?
Flower Child, Melanie. I think I am Melanie.
I will push back. Obviously, it's your band, so don't take this with a grain of salt. I do think you are a punk band, and I think because to me, punk eventually gets codified and people take it up differently, but are very adamant of it has to be this thing or that thing. But to me, it's about disrupting what it means to be a musician, what it means to be a quote unquote rock star, what it means to be just making art in this sort of commodified version of this thing. And that's why as soon as I found out that there is sort of this and a ten, like tenuous punk connection, it rang so clear to me that you are a punk band because that's what your band has done throughout my entire period of listening to you.
How is that different from just rock and roll in general?
Because most rock and roll bands want to be famous and they follow a code. Like I was thinking about this because Mo Tucker, I was reading about Mo Tucker today, and then the original Velvet's drummer who quit because he thought they sold out when they played their first paying gig in 1965. There's this sort of two streams of this rock music. And I think you even bring it up in that documentary where you talk about cinema verite and the influence of cinema verite and trying to like reflect real life in a way and an authentic life versus rock and roll and mainly pop rock and roll, which is all about edifice and sort of building up this edifice and hiding what's
Yeah,
real.
I think authenticity is a silly marketing gimmick, and I want nothing to do with
This is going to be awesome.
I did have a conversation with Stephen about and he and I might disagree on this, and I welcome that, but that when I first met Stephen, zines were the way that we got. Sorry about that loud siren coming by. It's New York City life.
I don't hear it.
Oh, okay, good. Yay, Zoom. That zines were really our primary mode of getting information a lot of the time. And so we got into bands in certain scenes outside of New York, like in New Zealand and in UK and in California, that were a lot of them sort of spearheaded by pretty visionary. I mean, I'm saying this as a music manager. I guess I have a kind of a specific way of looking at things, but I was just thinking about people like Jeff Travis, who started Rough Trade and Blanco y Negro. And I was thinking about people like Alan McGee, who started Creation, and Roger Shepherd, who started Flying Nun. And these are all record, like sort of not just record labels, but sort of scenes that were very, I think, what in that mythology you're talking about of like DIY collectivism. My favorite band in high school was this band called the Raincoats, who are like very, they were very much punk in that way that I think you're talking about, which is sort of like this just I don't know, like I guess not very, what am I trying to say? It's not authentic. I think Stephen will bridle at the word authentic, but certainly an effort being made to express something. Yeah, he's like, like Jeff, I
At
just
the
think
same time, the Raincoats are so
about
unpunk in the sense of the association with aggression,
right.
and being louder than previously thought possible. They had a I feel like they're at least as much a feminist project as a punk band.
That's I think what I'm
And
very maybe
that's part of what we love about them.
right. I think that's actually what I'm saying is my kind of tangential metaphorical maybe way of talking about punk is like the idea of like carving, you know, working against a system and carving out a new space. And the Raincoats were certainly them and the Slits and, you know, Huggy Bear and so many of these Kleenex. They were all kind of, you know, there was a lot of pushing back going on in that world.
Yeah.
Well, I think those are two scenes I really wanted to touch on with you. The Dunedin Sound stuff and kind of like the 53rd and 3rd, Vaseline's shop assistants, kind of, I guess, twee, for lack of a better term, stuff in England. Because for me,
everything I ever knew about Edinburgh, I read in The Enemy. And but everything I ever learned about Dunedin, I learned in the record store, because there was no press coverage at all that I ever saw in the U.S. of New Zealand.
Right.
I still have never really seen, I haven't even seen a roundup of the who Chris Knox recorded. You just don't get that in the U.S. Whereas we did get NME, which was great, when NME was, you know,
great. Yeah.
And I think we also, maybe the scene was small enough that we sort of caught these bands when they came to town, right? Like, so when Belter Space, which was Hamish Kilgore from the Kleens band after that, showed up in Boston in, I don't know, 89 or something. It was so long ago, right?
90, negative numbers.
Negative numbers to 90 with the Bats. And also, I was just thinking, like, the Kleen very much in my mind, I think of as a punk band. I don't know.
Sure.
Chris Knox, very much I think of as a kind of a punk artist, you know, like a very like, I'm going to walk around in my Bermuda shirt and my bare feet and in the middle of winter and like, just, you know, just, I don't know. I guess it is a little bit tangential to punk as in like, you know, Jerry's Kids or something, but it's its own kind. And I think that maybe that's what you're referring to a little bit.
So maybe Jerry's Kids don't have any more of a claim on what punk is than Blondie does.
Right.
100%. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what I was trying to get at earlier, is that there is this sort of macho bravado to rock music. And it's disrupted by bands like the Shop Assistants and very much like the Dunedin stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but if you could, if like me, you consider rock music to be basically an invention of Little Richard, macho bravado is not part of the origin story.
And that's what I think punk is. It's bringing it back to where it's not, it doesn't have, like, this is all put on it because it's all marketing. Sex sells,
yep.
Misogyny sells, like all this shit is like forced on. And that's when the Kleen were on this podcast, a fantastic conversation with them. I really do feel like they 100% were like, we are a punk band. And this was their reaction to the bullshit they were dealing with. They were being beaten up by car culture dudes all the time. And they were like having to deal with this kind of stuff. So for their version of punk was going softer. Like, why would you go harder? Why don't you just go completely against what these people want and what these people are doing?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And Toy Love are singing about bisexuality, and Sneaky Feelings are singing about Paul Verlaine. It's
very punk.
Not a macho scene.
Yeah.
Right.
What we think of as New Zealand punk. But actually, the vast majority of things on the Flying Nun box set, which I have to say I can't stand, are macho culture.
Car culture?
Yeah. I think as you're right, like, it kind of goes on, and that's the sad evolution of punk, is that at a certain point, the industry subsides and kind of like just takes this shit away from the purity of it. But then that's the great thing about punk, is that there's a zeitgeist that you can't hold on to as a band, and eventually there'll be a younger group of kids.
Purity.
Well, I'm using these words. You're going to take me up on all these fucking words.
That's the point.
I know. I love it. This is why I want to talk to you, because I feel like the type of music you're making, especially in Boston at that time, like the type of punk that's taken up pop culturally from Boston, that Middle East show that you played with Buffalo Rome way back when, and we sort of like Buffalo the connection.
Rome? I don't think Steve knows about this, but there's a YouTube of very, very old.
83.
80 something. No, it's not that early, but we're old. We're not that old.
Is 86? No, it's definitely like 80s though, right? Yeah, I don't mean to be dating it wrong. Okay. But it has
Johnny Blood playing the Ream bass synthesizer.
I didn't realize that was called Buffalo Room. So it was and me, Johnny, and Amy Clark.
Amy Clark being the singer, yeah. It's really okay. Amy Clark and I went to we were to each other from when we were 14. It's this is old stuff. This is high school, maybe late high school.
What is she doing now?
She's a teacher in San Francisco.
That's so punk. Anyway,
what's that? She's very happy.
That's so punk.
That is so punk. Yes. She deals with little children all the time. I was just off mic talking to Damien about Happy Flowers singing I Want to Watch Cartoons at the Top of Their Lungs on stage, which is a very punk rock song in the fact that it's like a temper tantrum.
I kind of have jumped way ahead because I wanted to go back to this high school period that we're talking about. How did you both get into punk? I know you both met in high school, but
we did not get into punk.
You did.
Oh, no. I have never been into punk.
Wild Stare.
I am now into punk.
Did you like
music in general. I don't give a shit about the stupid labels.
Okay.
I believe punk is a marketing category, and it's completely cynical, just like grunge. And I think prog rock is a descriptive term, derogatory but descriptive. Punk is a marketing scheme.
We'll get to this.
And has 100 different meanings to people. And when people want to use it and think it's warm and fuzzy, they have one set of meanings. And when they want to dismiss something, they have another set of meanings. And I just don't think it's musically useful at all. But I'm happy to talk about why.
I can't wait to get this. So I guess, Claudia, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you came across it?
Well, I mean, I agree with Steven that neither Steven or I really identify as punk people. We don't have a lot of records in our record collections that are punk, but I have an old, don't.
I do, but only because I have a huge record collection.
We've talked about dozens of punk bands already.
It's true. I just don't dive. I don't define as a punk. I define as a hippie or a folky or whatever. But my older sister growing up was actually defined herself as a punk. She went to hardcore shows. She was a photographer at hardcore shows. She has an amazing, impressive line of hardcore photographs, which she shows around town now. And people get into the nostalgia of all of the stuff she did in the Boston hardcore scene and around. And she,
which would horrify the people who were there at the time.
Yeah, and she would go to all age shows in churches in Harvard Square that they had to cover up the stained glass, windows because the kids would just go crazy and explode everything. Just throw them, their bodies everywhere. I hid with terror from the punk world, and but I did absorb it, I guess, through that. And I think that if I really started to identify with punk stuff, it was more through the lens of what we were talking about earlier, which is bands that were just pushing against the Raincoats. Really were my favorite band ever in high school. I just adored the Raincoats. They only had three albums, but I just adored them. And I actually went in 1987, I got on an airplane to find them. I actually went to London, knocked on the door of Rough Trade and asked to see them because I loved them that much. And I wanted to give them, my cassette. And I did. They opened the door and there was Mike Holdsworthy, who's Gina Birch's husband. And he said, sure, want to come to tea? And we went to tea and I hung out with Gina Birch. And it was really a highlight of my life. So yes, in that sense, if we can put these sorts of feminist bands and these sorts of collective record companies, we haven't talked about the UK, but I think Stephen and I don't really identify so much with the US punk scene, but I think that we would vaguely identify with the UK world. I don't know if it's even called punk, but people like Tony Wilson were being pretty punk and in that way. I know I'm using this word very vaguely, but
what they were calling it was post-punk.
Right. So maybe we're a little bit more
not considered punk. They were considered post-punk.
And we were aware that Susie Sue and Robert Smith and all these people were identifying themselves as punk, but they were being branded as goth, new wave, whatever, So there was, I guess there's that. And we even like had a little relationship for 5 seconds with Malcolm McLaren. Like we do have like our own strange ways that we have interwoven with this world, but it's not in the most traditional way.
And please, Stephen, I don't mean to upset you with this thing, but I think punk is more like a religion, because you're right. Everyone has a different definition of it, and it's fucked up and it's terrible. I definitely admit that. There's Nazis bullshit that comes in with punk. There's horrible shit that comes in with punk. But there's also this moment that you're kind of talking about, Claudia, where there is this door that opens, and it's the Desperate Bicycles. Like, as much as the Buzzcocks have the first quote-unquote DIY punk record, it's really that Desperate Bicycles single where they say at the end, it was cheap, it was easy, go do it, and lay out how you put your own 7-inch. And the story is that John Peel played it, and the next day Rough Trade sold 25 copies, and those 25 people were the nexus, right, of that scene. That to me is punk. Like those.
So DIY for what Stephen and I would call more DIY or collectivism. Oh, I can definitely relate with that one with the Magnetic Fields, because when we started, we had a record company, which was us, me, Stephen, my mother, his mother, and our friend Diana, all put in like $100 or whatever and made a bunch of cassettes. And we had them done down at the tape complex. And then we hand put the tape covers on each one. And we had been doing this for years before that with cassettes that we never released. But this was the very first Magnetic Fields album.
It's just flashed into my mind for the first time in decades. My uncle wanted to put money into that. He wasn't cool enough, so I said no.
Yes, it was very much a like who's gonna invest. And
I want to bring up the coolness factor. Punk versus cool. I feel like punk and new wave are these labels where if you identify as one, at one point in my youth, you weren't supposed to be both. Like you weren't supposed to say, I like punk and new wave. No. That was like mods and rockers. But now they're completely the same thing. What I would have said that I liked in the late 70s would have been new wave. And I would have said that's Talking Heads, Blondie, Ramones, and anyone with a synthesizer.
Television, wire.
Other than Rick Wakeman. Yeah. I also liked Rick Wakeman and still do.
But it was a new wave.
It was not considered new wave.
Because on that...
Remember that song by Great Plains? Why do punk rock guys go out with new wave girls?
Yeah. Letter to a Fanzine, it's called.
That's a great example of the dichotomy that Stephen is talking about.
Right. And second verses, isn't my haircut really intense? Isn't Cave a genius in a sense?
Great Plains were a really great punk band, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, another band I wanted to bring up, it's not, I guess it's close to the new wave thing, and I think you guys cover it on the Cooking for Priests tape, is that Wild Stare band that was on Propeller Records?
Wild Stairs. Yeah, they were, I would say that they would identify themselves as either punk or experimental post-punk or something like that, right, Stephen?
I would have to ask them, but they did have a drum machine, so I think new wave would be a more cozy category for them.
Well, that's interesting too, because I find Boston, out of all the scenes, kind of has like, are you familiar with Lord Manuel? Someone I just recently learned about, really kind of outsider electronic records. He did one single with his sister called like Electrica or something, late 70s, but he's backed on that Lord Manuel stuff by La Peste, like that sort of first wave Boston punk band that Matador reissued way later. So there is this moment where it does feel like the two things were kind of aligned a little bit more. And I think V too, Susan Enway's band, rest in peace.
Yeah.
I feel like that band also feels like they kind of straddle that line.
Well, we thought they were new wave, but whatever. We would never have hired Susan Anway if we knew that she was punk.
She actually ended up becoming like a Irish folk. So, you know, it really
yeah,
is like.
Right. She was Celtic.
She's a Celtic folk person. Yeah. For a long time, which you can tell by listening to her voice. You know, her voice is very lilting and kind of Irish-y.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I think your point, I don't think it's worth belaboring this endlessly. Like, I get your point, you know, that there's this sort of do-it-yourself, trying to push against restraints of trying to do things in the, or maybe just not imagining that we could, you know, like in the early days, like how on earth are we going to get a record deal? Oh, we have to make a whole lot of tapes and send them to people and beg them to release our singles. But it was easier, I guess, although now there's the internet, so maybe it's much easier now. But another thing that we did, along with making all those cassettes at the tape complex and hand doing them and mailing them out, and then we made CDs, 1,000, that's what we got the money for, 1,000 CDs. We called ourselves Pop-Up Records, and because we like pop-up art. And then we were able to license those things to other indie labels. So yeah, there was this sort of like doing it ourselves. I don't know how much that's punk, but that's certainly what we were doing. And another thing we did, because I don't know if anybody remembers the old, what were they called? Xerox store, you know, the copy store was like a big, big part of early DIY music culture, like along with the record store, the copy store. Nobody gives them the credit they deserve, but not only did you make all your posters for your shows, but you actually made your records there. So we would go in and like our very first single, 100,000 Fireflies, was made at the copy store, you know, like just Xeroxed a whole lot of these beautiful what was it, Stephen? It was like sort of, it was like a kind of a blue metallic cover that somehow we found a machine that did that, and they created these, and then we put them on these sleeves. And anyway, the point is that everything was very much handmade, and I guess that on some level is a spirit of punk in its way, in the sense that it was doing it yourself.
I kind of feel like it's
I do think that do-it-yourself culture dates back a lot further than 1977. But also, I think it's really different in the US from Britain. In Britain, like you said, there's 25 people and that's a scene. And it's London and it's the rough trade shop.
Mm-hmm. Or the punk scene on King's Road, right? Like you've got your
the 100 Club thing.
Whereas in the US, there's 50 major cities that have
their own little
scenes, and we had gigantic roads between every pair of cities, and that they just don't have that in the UK. It's they were two major newspapers, and the Jesus and Mary Chain was on the cover of the NME before they ever had a tape out.
Like John Peel, yeah.
They had only played live.
Mm-hmm. And here we had fanzines and touring, which we didn't really do, but there was
the idea. And no national magazines that had anything like NME or Melody Maker.
Not until the 90s, right? Because then you get Puncture and Magnet and stuff, but that's later. Yeah.
But, and we had Op and Option and... Well, it's just looking at Search and Destroy from the 70s, and that was San Francisco, but that didn't even have, we didn't know about Search and Destroy until Research reissued it, you know, because in the US it's so splintered. But in the UK, doing something at Rough Trade Records constituted being in the epicenter of culture. And there's just no equivalent to that. The epicenter of culture at the time in the U.S. was Studio 54 and 25 other things.
Yeah.
But there's no record store that was the epicenter of culture at all.
It's fascinating in England how much more, and maybe it's less so these days, but like back certainly in the heyday of these weekly magazines, how much music culture, especially underground music culture, was just part of the larger pop culture there versus over here where like
it was more accepted. Like you could have Lawrence from Felt or something showing up in some. I do think you're right about that. it was a little less like here. It's more like there's the upper and the lower, and there was sort of more mushed.
Yeah, and the same.
Lawrence Van Pelt was boyfriends with the singer of Saint Etienne.
Yes. Right.
And he was played on John Peel, and John Peel had 10 years earlier started Dandelion Records, which is arguably the first DIY label in Britain. I think John Peel's, we think of John Peel as a saint for the punk alternative period, but he was actually already a saint 10 years earlier. Dandelion was absolutely hippie music, but it was the same technique. You know, if you have a radio show, you have
this is like that outrage. It's like that outrage that people feel when you learn that rap largely derives from disco. It's the same feeling of like,
yeah, right. Yeah.
What? That can't be. You're like, oh, wait a minute. Look, Monica Lynch, you know, works in the disco world and writes a fanzine and then goes off and works at Tommy Boy for
20 years. And what do you think Afrika Bambaataa was playing at that party? You know,
I think that's the marketing that's been put on it. The anti-hippie thing, like it goes way back to the start, but a lot of this stuff came out of hippie culture, and like the amount of yippie people that managed bands or gave bands places to rehearse or do their shows, like,
yeah.
And or like even Pink Fairies in England too. And sort of this sort of, freaky hippie scene, the Fugs in America. Like there is 100%. That.
Right, they were a lot more confrontational than the Sex Pistols were.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, 100%. I'm so glad you mentioned the Fugs. That's so right. I was also just thinking about like that song Roadrunner by Modern Lovers or early, obviously Velvet Underground. I mean, totally, you know, like there's this idea that their music was pretty punk, like early punk, but they were hippies, you know, like John Richmond is such a hippie. I don't know. Yes, I'm pleased that you're making that connection because I obviously identify as a hippie, so it makes me happy. and another thing I was thinking about, because I woke up this morning singing Goo Goo Muck in my head at 6:30 and 6 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting there singing Goo Goo Muck, and I was like, why am I singing Goo Goo Muck? And I realized it was because I was thinking about the thing that's always surprised me as I kind of get older and older about, you know, the Ramones and the Cramps, and I guess maybe even the Dickies, but certainly we love the Dickies, by the way, but certainly the Ramones and the Cramps is that they're just nostalgically redoing the 50s, you know, like that song is like a 50s song, and like, you know, or Rocky Horror Picture Show, or I mean, there's so many examples of this, you know, like this sort of nostalgia for the 50s, like doo-wop scene done as punk is unironic in my mind.
In New York, we had the Peppermint Lounge on Fifth Avenue and 14th Street. There had been a few different locations, but it was the 50s nostalgia for cool people. It was not Happy Days.
Yeah.
It was the Cramps.
I think that the Ramones and the Cramps genuinely listened to this music growing up and genuinely are writing this music, except they're doing it in their, like, holy shit, like, the 70s was a really bad decade. Like, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's just, or whatever the 60s did to them. You know, like, it just strikes me that there's a nostalgia as well as an irony in there is what I'm trying to say. It's not just ironic, like Happy Day, or I don't know if ironic's the right word, but it's not just making fun. There's like I think when Richard O'Brien wrote Rocky Horror, he's actually doing 50s music. Like, I think he's actually doing 50s music, you know? So it's, I don't know, I guess that just struck me, like, and so for some reason, as I'm walking around the apartment singing Goo Goo Muck, that sure, it's considered punk now, but it's like, it's kind of 50s music. Or like, you know, you mentioned the Fugs, but what was I just thinking of? The Troggs, you know, like there is this kind of like, I don't know, it's all evolves, but it's on some level unironically 50s is what I'm trying to say.
I was on a Zoom call, my previous Zoom call to this one, a month or two ago, was with Chris Stein and Deborah Harry.
Yeah,
and
them too, 50s.
And
Denise, and all that.
And they were saying, we loved everything.
Yeah.
And we still love everything. We don't identify as a particular subset. We want to bring all of the music together, and why label us? That's my attitude. But we don't have a preferred marketing category. We get put on particular lists, but I don't know. We didn't put ourselves there.
Oh, I think like people always say punk is this postmodern genre. And I think it is in the sense that it's picking from 50s rock and roll, like bringing in reggae, bringing in, I guess culture vulture would be the negative way of looking at it, but it is taking from all these different things and trying to construct something. And you're going to probably hate these words, authentic to these people, to yourself, like what is real. And I feel maybe it's not a sonic that unites it. Maybe it's sort of this idea of the formal kind of rejection of the metrics of success and what it means to be a popular band. Like I see that with the Fugs, like they're swearing on those records. It was never going to get played on the radio. Velvet Underground, but more with Jonathan Richman, like Jonathan Richman, the Modern Lovers, like there's this moment where he kind of just stops playing, right? Like electric music. He's like, it's too loud. Starts putting pillows on the drums to mute everything and goes way more childlike in his approach. But that to me is super punk. And that's sort of as if they're the proto punk.
Right. Ken Rubin did it before he did. Yeah.
Before he did? Because he's doing it
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I mean, they started singing happy songs about dinosaurs. Yeah.
John Richman's doing it in like 77 by the time he's like, then the Modern Lovers break up. And he's like, no, I just want to play like old people's songs.
Oh, I thought you meant the later. Childlike stuff.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, like, but you're right. Like, there's that sort of thing that also happens with Perubu, and there's this sort of Wild Happy Flowers too. Like we were talking earlier, Claudia, they're another band where it's nostalgia, but it's I don't know. There's something.
Well, the thing that none of us have brought up because we keep talking about authentic, which just makes Stevens
so mad. I'm so
itch. It makes him do this thing. Would be to actually maybe bring up the idea of production. Anti-production value, like you know, when Happy Flowers is playing an instrument
which the Beatles invented on the White Album.
Yeah, which the Beatles invented on the White Album. But the point is, like, this idea of we are actively going to make this not sound a way that your ears are used to. We're going to do something either with swearing or with loudness or with quietness that is not in
Carole
keeping.
King Tapestry is all about the denial of the big productions that the original songs that she was doing had been subjected to by herself. She had originally been making the Shirelles demos that turned into the records, and she insisted that those records sounded like her demos, or she wouldn't work with those people again. So she was originally a big production mover and shaker, and then went in absolutely the opposite direction 10 years later to do Tapestry as absolutely minimal, no reverb at all, close miking everything. You never imagine that you're in a room at all. It's just aggressively
stripped
like
down.
You can hear the saliva in her mouth.
That sounds like trying to be real. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Oh yeah,
that's like a side. That's like the first cousin of authentic.
It's authentic, but it's also absolutely artificial because it couldn't have existed with the technology of just 10 years earlier. She's using a 16-track tape and making everything is in your face. And that just didn't exist before. And then the Beatles were, you know, also for the White Album, they're subtracting all of this George Martin. Basically, they're removing George Martin's taste from their own approach. And then quickly they get so tangled up and against each other that Phil Spector, Mr. Production, has to come and rescue them.
Everybody's trying to get to that.
But yeah, it's all authentic, right?
Yeah,
it's all exactly as authentic as anything else. But it's new technologies, and a lot of the time with what we would like to call punk, New Zealand. It's old technology, like Chris Knox recording the chills and the bats and the sneaky feelings on his four track. That four track is what they were using to record in 1967,
right.
15 years earlier. That was the same kind of machine that they recorded Sergeant Pepper on.
But I think, Claudia, you brought up earlier with this.
That's like if we were going back to ADAT now.
Yes.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
I think technology does play a big part in it too, though. Like you're saying, the advent of the photocopier, and the advent of the tape deck, and these bring the means of production of culture into the hands of young people and
yes,
artists.
Yeah, having a cassette. I mean, I don't know if you guys did this, but you have the boombox and you'd sing into it, and then you'd have a second boombox. This is like the Daniel Johnston recording method, and then you'd play your cassette from one boombox into your other boombox, and you go back and forth. I made records that way for a little while. And when I was a child.
I'd made records an analogous way for the first five Magnetic Fields records. I had a computer with a four channel software. So right. I was recording on four track. It was just digital.
I'd
bounce it to DAT and back.
Yes, I remember it well.
And that's why we have no multi-tracks.
That's why we can't give anybody... Everybody's like, "Oh, we want to put this in our television show. Can you give us the original, stout?"
No, we
like,
can't.
It's like Steven made stew.
Yeah,
he made a giant stew. You can have the stew, or you cannot have the stew.
Right,
but that's what it is.
But you can't have the ingredients.
I do appreciate your point about cassette and the copy store. I hadn't thought of them as new, but of course they were new in the 80s. They were newish. You know, they weren't new, but they were new.
Well, and you made your cassette on a four track cassette deck. That was a new.
I had my Tascam four track. Yep.
Yeah.
But before that, I had
my four track, my TIAC A3440 was from, I think probably 1970, but I got it in 1981.
Was quarter inch, like cassette,
yeah.
Quarter inch. No, it's
cassette. Quarter inch tape.
Yeah,
but reel to reel.
For some reason, we also had a big fascination with Crepas, which it really has nothing to do with this conversation, except it's a little punk, I guess. We used to like decorate everything with Crepas. Then you tried sticking it into your tape player, and it would like kind of destroy your tape player.
There was that, yeah.
There was this Crepas thing. I don't know what it was all about. Like, I remember once we made a whole cassette that was just pink with Crepas, which just like covered the entire thing with Crepas.
Yeah, and you can smear it, or you can combine it with peanut butter.
You can put it in your hair. There was a lot of stuff being put in our hair in the 80s to make our hair do this. So yeah, I guess
it's probably worth talking about punk as a movement with nothing to do with sound at all. and just hair.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that there could be you could write a book about punk for deaf people and have just no reference at all to sound music. Being made.
Yeah.
Because culturally it's about hair.
Yeah.
And fashion and film, right? Like you could do art photography. Like there's just so many, like to me, it just opened a door and anything could come through at that point, because to push back on Tapestry and the White Album, those are great records, not taking anything away from the records and obviously the motivations of the artists, but they were successful doing that. I think it's different when you approach it like you're doing, where you guys are disrupting, you're playing these shows, you're talking to the audience while you're playing, like right back, watching that Middle East show from way back when, you're talking to the audience, you're engaging with the audience, and it's so
different. No, that's her.
Well, it's her, but you do it now too.
So, a little bit.
I do not talk to the audience while I'm playing a song.
Not a huge fan of talking to the audience.
Not a huge fan.
Not but, while playing a music a song. No.
No. Okay, but in the middle of a set versus like Kiss.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus these bands.
Oh, Oklahoma or whatever.
Yeah, like just disrupting things, and I think that's the great thing about this thing. And like we can talk about it without the music, without the visuals, without anything. Yeah. This.
Sorry. It's my turn to have the siren. It's really fire truck going by. Sorry.
No problem.
I didn't hear the last 10 seconds of what you said.
No, I was just going to say, I feel like this is where there was an honor in doing it yourself. And there, obviously, you're saying, this DIY has existed forever, but in a lot of times it was a means to an end. Like, I'm going to try and do this to get to the next stage. Whereas with punk, in terms of pop music, it was about, no. You do it because this is what you do. And when I got into it, I was still making my own tapes. I was still photocopying at Kinko's because this was the culture that was handed down to me. And it was not just permission to do it, but here are the tools that you can do it, where you don't need much money. You need a little bit of money, but you don't need much money. You don't need access. You can just do it yourself. And that's the punk thing.
So I have been invited to have a Substack account. Substack is the way that writers actually get paid nowadays. They get paid directly. It's very DIY. It's directly in that lineage. And what am I going to do with my Substack account? I'm going to have a zine, because, like you say, that's what I know. I know how to do that. I'm literally going to go to the FedEx Kinko's across the street and copy things onto pink paper and whatever color I feel like, and then put it on Substack. Like, the distribution will be digital, but the production will be putting pieces of paper together with staples.
And I still find that that's the way I put stuff together. Like, even though I'm not very good with this computer, so when I'm actually putting together I haven't done a zine in a few years, but when I did zines or when I'm doing like a layout for something, I'm going to a photocopy place, cutting stuff out, gluing it down with a glue stick and photocopying. Probably not the most efficient way to do things, but like you're saying, that production, and it's not just an aesthetic, it's like an ethos in that type of production. Like that still rings.
Yeah. Using your hands to do something. Using your hands to glue it together with the glue stick is quite different from moving it around with the mouse. Thank you for reminding me I need to go get a glue stick. I haven't had one in quite a long time.
I bought a fancy one.
I've got 10 of them here.
Yeah.
So you
do too. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe bring one
to on rehearsal. Tour. I will come.
Yeah.
Glue sticks for you to rehearsal. So in a way, like the you can call this podcast The Magnetic Fields, Peeling the Onion of Authenticity. But I do
pissing
think
that, on the onion of authenticity.
Pissing on the onion of authenticity. But I do think that in a way the word punk, as loosely defined as we are doing it, is somehow tangentially more, I think, about DIY and maybe stuff like feminism. And or expression of feeling some sort of lack of control and wanting to have control. I actually just had this like huge flashback to 1986 CMJ Festival, where I went as a freshman in college, and there was, you know, Gerard and co on their panel, and you know, everybody was, you know, it was like Thurston and Kent, you know, it was like such a little New York kind of college. We haven't even talked about college radio, but anyway, it was this sort of scene where, you know, it was like all these people kind of knew each other, Byron Cole, you know, it was all these people wandering around who were like, hey, 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 hey. And then there was this incredible heavy metal panel. You know this story, Stephen?
Mm-hmm.
I went with Jad Fair to this panel, which was kind of in itself amazing, right? So yeah. Sitting in the heavy metal panel with Jad Fair. And the reason I'm telling the story is it's like the inversion of this entire conversation we're having today, because everybody at the panel acted like they were on, like, I don't know, Top of the Pops or whatever. I don't know. Give me the name of something huge. You know, they were on like the biggest radio show or the biggest TV show in the country. I mean, they were wearing their mirrored glasses and they had their hair perfect and their face perfect and their clothes perfect. And everybody in the room was sort of staring at them. I mean, there were people who genuinely loved, it was like, you know, Mike Monroe from Hanoi Rocks. And, you know, it was, I mean, Lemmy was there from Motorhead. I mean, these were like big shot guys, unfortunately all guys, but what got, hold on, I'll tell
the great cast
for that part. Yes. Yeah, but what made it funny was that no one was recording it for national television or national radio. It was just it was just a panel at CMJ. So in a way, that's kind of like, I don't know, the DIY folks like win on some weird level. You know, like we're all in the room just being, I mean, there were obviously some diehard metal fans who were just like, whoa, yeah, 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 you know, like really excited. But the people on the panel just drank their own Kool-Aid to such an amazing extent that it actually made them kind of amazing. Like it made you in the audience look at them like, wow, like you really are authentic. I don't know how else to put it. Like you really believe in yourself to such an unbelievable degree. So like there was this moment where one of them was like, yeah, when our drummer died. And I literally started to laugh because, you know, Spinal Tap had already come out. It was hilarious. And it wasn't funny that his drummer had died, except that it was really funny that his drummer had died. And I don't know what I'm trying to say. I guess what I'm trying to say is that they took themselves incredibly seriously, and everybody in the room was not up for that task because we had all just been trying desperately to, like, I don't know, get our tape to Gerard or whatever for the last 4 years. And then there's these guys like, anyway, you get my point. Like,
I get it. Yeah.
Acting like they were on the biggest station ever or the biggest. Yeah.
And you found that to be a form of authenticity.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were authentic in how fake they were.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They really believed in themselves.
They were true to their genre.
Yes. They really believed in themselves. They really, like Kiss, like what you were saying, like this idea of, so I guess for Stephen and me, authentic has a negative connotation, which has to do with buying into your own shtick. Yeah. Although we like it when it's ironic, like Alice Cooper. I mean, we have to believe that Alice Cooper, to a certain degree, sees through some of this. Or
Alice Cooper is all about the showmanship. Yeah, yeah.
Or Ozzy Osbourne or whatever. I mean, these guys are
they have senses of humor, and they share that with the audience while keeping up the show.
I have to believe that Lemmy was like thinking to himself, what the hell am I doing on this panel? Because he was just like a regular person. He wasn't dressed like a glam rocker or with like wearing his sunglasses inside. And anyway, it was.
So he wasn't doing Lemmy.
And there's straight up interviews with Lemmy where he's like, I feel more in common with the punk kids than I do with the metal kids.
Yeah. You can feel that from him. He was also, wasn't he just kind of older than everyone? Wasn't everybody in that band kind of?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Kind of outlived their genre or something. And they were just.
First band, he was the lyricist for, and it's called Sam Gopal. They didn't have a drummer, they had a tabla player.
The record's amazing.
It's great.
And then the Hawkwind stuff he did too, like that's
I forgot he was that band.
You know, Lemmy is a lot more wide-ranging than his later shtick would allow us to think. I mean, he was still writing for Sam Gopal, he's already writing about the Dark Lord, but over tablas. So I'm really feeling crappy and I want to go.
I get it. I get it. Well, if you want to stick around, Claudia, we can talk more, but if you want to go too,
I should probably go with Stephen, but is it like a last
not thing? Really. I think you have stories that you have not yet told. And if I didn't feel crappy, I would continue, but I think
I can do like 10 minutes. I'd also need
a smaller room.
Well, I didn't even get to ask you about control bleeding or any of this other stuff. That's Salem Mort comp, anything. So, or Harriet Records. I can't believe I didn't talk to you about Harriet Records.
I will talk to you about Harriet Records.
Well, and at some point, Stephen, when you feel better in the future, years from now, when you can tolerate more of this conversation about punk and stuff, please know you're always welcome on this show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I did really want to talk to you about 100,000 Fireflies and Harriet Records, because I love that label, Scarlet Drop from Canada, for the Canadian connection there.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how that single, like how many were pressed of it? Do you know?
I think it was like I said, we did it over at Typo Tech, which was our local copy store in Harvard Square. Tim Alborn I was undergrad at Harvard, and he was a professor at Harvard. And I don't remember if we met at Harvard or if we met when I was still in high school, I think somehow we knew each other through like the zine land even before, because I came to Harvard as a junior. I came very late. So I think I actually knew him when I was still in my other college in New York. So I don't actually understand, but Tim and I somehow met. He would remember. But then we ended up in the same place, which was kind of convenient. And we went to this place, Typo Tech, which was just literally across the street from where all the dorms were and everything. And we made it. I think he must have made it, but we designed this record cover of this metallic record cover. And we made this funky little weird sticker that said, "Listen to the Magnetic Fields." I just remember doing it all at Typo Tech. It was like very handmade. And I don't know if we put them in the sleeves. I think the Typo Tech staff put them in the sleeves for us, 500 or so, or 1,000, or it was very small.
But it got around, right? Because like Superchunk covers that song like a year later or 2 years later.
Maybe a little more than that, but yeah. Like, really? Didn't they do it? I don't remember.
It's on a 10 inch, I think. I think it's on the 10 inch.
No. The question is, how fast is the name of their EP? And I remember that. I just don't remember what year it was. We could Google that. But anyway, so the single, I mean, this is where we haven't talked about college radio, which is just a huge part of our whole story, mythology of our lives. And I guess most people from that era, college radio. So in America, like Stephen was saying, you can't actually reach all these different fiefdoms and all these different towns, but actually college radio and zines and things like that were doing their best, right, to kind of mush these things around. So I guess it was Jacksonville, Florida, oddly enough, that Tim must have sent all those singles to all those different cool college radio stations around the country. And Jacksonville's college radio station really went crazy with that single. And it went up the CMJ charts. Really, it was through college radio that 100,000 Fireflies made its splash. And then we put out this little pop-up records, which has that song on it. It's the first of the first Magnetic Fields album. Now is a double album, but it was the first of that. It was called Distant Plastic Trees. And we put that out. And then we get it like licensed immediately again to another label. And then we get a license to Merge. So at some point in like the, God, I'm really bad with dates, but at some point I'm sitting at like, oh my God, my brain, the amazing record store in Hoboken. I wish Stephen were here. Anyway, that place. And I ran into Mac from Superchunk, who I'd gone to my first college with. Both of us transferred out of Columbia, but he and I knew each other when we were kids, like freshmen. And he said, "Hey, can I release, you know, that Distant Plastic Trees record?" And I said, "Well, we just signed it to this other company." And then the point is it bounced from label to label and then finally got to Merge. And that's the beginning of the Merge story.
It's interesting too with Mac, because that's someone else who I find, you know, in talking to him, being on the label and stuff, has that like deep understanding.
Pure Platters.
Pardon me? Pure Platters. Pure
Platters. Sorry, that was the name of the record store. I was going to lose my mind. Go ahead. No,
I find with Mac, it's fascinating because he's got like, he's another person like yourselves that got the Flying Nun stuff. Like, it feels like the Flying Nun stuff was like a secret language, and I was lucky enough to get it through Homestead and Merge putting out those records.
Yes.
But it really does feel like that is like the like a secret code between people.
Yeah, Flying Nun, and for us, I mean, we were into the psychedelic scene too in California, so Paisley Underground. We had all these different little worlds that we were obsessed with, and definitely Rough Trade and all the guys out in England. Interestingly, 53rd and 3rd was later for me. I mean, I definitely had my Shop Assistants records and stuff, but that world, it was more for me. I guess it was just more like what I just said. So yeah, no, I mean, Mac, I didn't know him well at Columbia, but we knew each other. And then somehow we ran into each other in this record store. I think it was like 1990 or 91. And at that point we'd already put out these, like I said, so he then relicensed it. And then Stephen was sort of already heading off into new records. So he got to package the first two. And then it was just weird. Like, the whole early 90s is us just like trying to figure out. It's like very, it's very amorphous. We have all these different record labels and we're trying to figure out which ones. And like I said, I'm like banging my head against many walls, trying to get money from people who won't pay. And oh, there's all sorts of stories, which you can probably read about in the Merge book. And then finally, it all just thankfully just consolidated with Merge. But we had like two records come out in 1 year because one label was taking so long. It was just very chaotic.
It's interesting that you describe like sort of the ascent of the band, because it feels like right from that single getting played on Jacksonville, and obviously you've been a band for a long time prior to this, or a few years before this, but you guys are a part of the musical landscape from that point on.
Well, college radio was really, really great. That's all I have to say. I mean, I, of course, because I was a manager and I was trying so hard to push things forward, I wanted to make it to WFNX or WBCN or KEXP, whatever. I wanted to get out. I don't know what these labels, what these places were called.
Yeah.
The big K ones in the West Coast. Like,
K-Rock.
I wanted to get K-Rock. I want to be on K-Rock. We did, oddly enough, we did get played on K-Rock with the Future Bible Heroes for like 1 hour of one day. We actually had a song on K. It was so exciting. But so I guess I always had this idea that there was something bigger. But yes, there was this sort of teapot of excitement of college radio success and a little bit of recognition that way. And, you know, getting our singles on the CMJ, you know, the little disc you got with your CMJ catalogs. And it's funny. It's also far long ago. It's like almost like another person, another life. But yes, there was that little kind of small feeling of recognition. We played a lot of live concerts on our local college radio stations. We did that. We did MBR, we did ZBC, we did HR, whatever it was, Harvard Radio Station, HRB. You know, we did all these. And I always accidentally swore. That was like my problem. Like, I'd get up there and be like, don't swear, don't swear, don't swear. You know that weird thing where you're like, you're not supposed to swear, so then you just do. And then they would have to like shut down the entire station for like 3 seconds and like yell at me. And then anyway, so we did a lot of on-air performing in the early 90s. Or the
Well, and that period, your bands being collectively the bands of that era really kind of establish the type of band that my band's in, obviously sonically very different, but the idea that you don't have to be played on the K-Rocks, and
right,
there is a way to kind of do this as a career in between a hobby band and a professional band. Like, not that we're not professionals, but I mean, like, in terms of like, you can make this work as like a DIY. I don't know. I'm very conscious of what I say. Stephen's made me double think everything, but
yeah,
you know what I'm saying, right? Like, an indie band, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah. He bridled against that term too. So I'm glad you didn't bring it up while he was on the call.
Oh, I knew not. I was safe with you
the word indie, but yes, I think indie is probably the definitional word for that time. Not mainstream. Right. And yet we were all kind of pining for it. At least I was. I wanted more and more and more. And all of our parents were like, you got to go to grad school. You got to get a real job. You can't, you know. So it wasn't like, oh, wow, we're really making a career out of this. It was like, this is literally our hobby. Except for Steven, who was like, this is my job. This is what I do. But the rest of us, I mean, Sam and me and all of us, we were just like, we have to go to grad school and become a whatever, you know, a lawyer, a teacher. He went for law. I went for teaching. we did not think that this was, you know, possible to not have a, be, we had to have a day job. Steve had a day job. Yeah, we all had day jobs.
Yeah, and there's still, like, day jobs are part of, I think, this type of band, or, like, there's a, you have to figure something else to make it work, but there's this idea that you can do this, and be, and especially the longevity of yourself, Superchunk, too, like, these bands that, it, you don't have to exist in a narrow window, like the Beatles or something. You can be a band and make this your life, and your, this is your life's work.
Right.
And I kind of,
it's, oh, go on, sorry. It's like a, it is an interesting kind of marriage feeling. Like, you just feel like you're very married to it, and there's a lot of love in it. And yet, yeah, it's not, maybe in a weird way, it is like an open marriage, because you have your job and you have your other things that you do and your other identities that you can take off and put on. So you don't feel as, like, I thought it was really, I don't know, inspiring or something that Laura graduated to not being in the band. And I almost, within a year or two of that, stopped being in my band too. Like, you know, she had ear problems and she was like, I'll be on the records, but I can't do this touring thing anymore. And I, that felt really brave. And I'm sure it was medically necessary too, but it also felt kind of brave because of the identity of this. And I also, you know, I had to, at a certain point, I had a kid, and I just was like, this isn't working, you know? So I too stopped for, I don't know, a decade. That was intense, you know, but I was still on the records and still managing it and still very involved. And, but not having that, like, excitement of the limelight and being on stage, it's definitely something hard to shed.
Did you miss it? Like, was that something that was hard to kind of, like, put away?
I missed some things. I was very jealous. I think that's the better phrase. Like, oh man, they're in Cork, Ireland. I want to be in Cork. And I had that feeling all the time. You know, like, oh, they're in, you know, Athens. I want to be in Athens. I'm in Brooklyn. I want to be in Athens, you know?
Yeah.
They're going to places I've never been. You know, they went to, was it Chile last year? They went somewhere in Latin America that I've never been. I think somewhere very far away. So that's cool, right? That's cool. And they got to play really big festivals, and that was cool too. So yeah, kind of jealous, but also very much realizing that I can't have two lives at the same time. I have a teen, a preteen teen, and nobody's going to feed her if I'm not, if I'm not there. And I have another career too. I'm working as a social worker now. So yeah, it's hard. It's hard to not want to have it all. But I've sort of come to, I had to go through something, but now I've sort of come to a place of understanding.
I'm asking this on a personal level, because I find that it's the double life of trying to raise kids, especially preteens, teenagers, and then also go on the road and be this sort of perpetual teenager living this sort of, like, teenage fantasy of being in a touring band in a van.
Yeah. No, I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm not doing much of it anymore. So that's my answer. I think that boys have a little bit of a way out if you have a female partner at home who's being more of, like, the mom. I think it's a little harder for mom to take off than dad. I know that's sexist of me, and I just happen to have that kind of gender essentialism in me that maybe is wrong, a little old school. But I guess I feel like, having been raised by a dad who had to work all the time to make money anyway, I just feel like, well, didn't see a whole lot. See a whole lot of him either, so, you know, that's mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, obviously I love my dad and I loved the time I spent with him, but I think it would have been a little more harsh and intense and maybe even traumatic if it had been mom who had taken off as much as my dad did. So that's just what I've been raised with, and maybe it's wrong, I don't know.
Well, but there is that choice that has to be made, though, like you're saying, like, there's, you can't be at home and be in this band at the same time. And it's, and something's got to give. And it's funny. Well, I'll talk to, like, I forget who it was. Someone from, like, a really big band was like, yeah, being on the road's real hard, but, you know, it's great, 'cause we bring our kids on the road. And I was just thinking, it does not work for the type of economic band that I'm in to do that.
We brought my daughter in 2012, which was the last time I toured with them. For 9 weeks. She was 16 to 18 months old. And it was really an unmitigated disaster. I would not do that again. It was a bad idea. She had a great time running all over the airport, but I was beyond exhausted and having panic attacks every day, because I was like, I just can't physically keep up this energy level. I can't be up until 2 and then up at 7 in the morning and then I was such a wreck. And I had some help. I had a person who came along, but it was too much even for them. It was just so much to do that. So anyway, I waited a decade. Now she's 13. It's easier. And I will be going out with them for, you know, a month, and it will be hard. It will be hard to not, but I can text with her and, you know, she can stay at friends' houses now. It's a little less intense, but yeah.
I think you deserve a medal for doing that. That's fucking crazy. Like,
well, I did stop touring for forever after that. Just like, I had to get very quiet and alone for a long time after that. I was a wreck. I really did. I think I may have had like a mini nervous breakdown after that. I was really a wreck. But anyway.
I think it requires, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
I think it requires two very different mentalities to be the parent versus being the rock star, quote unquote, the person on stage. Because one is, you can't be selfish at all when you're raising your kids. It has to be about them, right? But if you're not selfish as that person on stage, it doesn't work. Like, if you don't believe you can fly, you're going to crash to the ground. So like, I couldn't imagine trying to do that at the same time. I find there's like a weird day after I get off tour trying to readjust, like, oh, it's not about me, right?
Yeah.
But to try and do that every day like you're doing, that is,
well, she was so little that wasn't actually in play that much. The only thing that was like that was really quite heartbreaking for me was that the next year I went out with Future Babble Heroes for just like a week. And I guess that the first year she never came to any sound checks or shows because she was so little. She was a year and a half old. But the next year she was like three. And so we let her stand in the bell house during sound check, and she heard my voice like above through the big speakers, and she didn't have a concept of like microphones or amplification, or except for, I guess, listening to a CD at home. But like, you know, she didn't have this concept that like the person could be talking and then you could hear this like huge giant version of their voice amplified all over the place. And she just burst into tears hysterically and was really distraught. And my friends who were minding her, like kind of swooped her up and ran home with her and just like played with her and like distracted her. And by the time I got there after sound check, she was smiling and laughing. But I was so worried about how devastated she had gotten. And actually after that, we really kept her out of the venues. She did in the very last Future Babble Heroes show, which was like 10 days later, she did, I don't know how she got her head around it. First, we showed her, I guess, through the window, me on stage. And then we finally walked her in, and she actually danced, and it was really moving for me. Awesome. It was at you know, that place that they record Terry Gross. What is it? Kate. Anyway, there's a venue associated with the Philadelphia radio station. I'm sorry, my brain is just gone completely out the window, but it'll come to me. Anyway, this is a problem I'm having lately. I forget everything. But anyway, it was a very small, very pretty little venue. So it didn't seem like she was going to be as freaked out because it was sort of quiet. And anyway, so what do you want to talk about that's like for the podcast that you can edit in if there's anything? We talked about Harry.
This is great. This has been amazing. Like, I would love to talk to you. Like, I don't want to keep you all day, because honestly, I've got so many nerdy things, but like, it's, there's like, I would love like, okay, one last thing. How did that Manuals of Insect Life comp, which I think is the first appearance of Magnetic Fields on a release, right? That comp?
Yeah. That one is lost to the sands of time. I think it must have been through a, you know, somebody reading a review in a zine. The guy at Salem Moore, he had a French name. I've lost it. I'm sure we could find it by looking.
Gerard Helm or Woodrow Dumas?
Yeah, Dumas, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He contacted me back then, I guess, through the mail. That's about as far as I'm going to get with that. Must have seen the P.O. box on the back of the record and said, I want to do a single. And we were like, sure. And we gave him Crowd of Drifters sung by Susan, which is actually interesting because that song appears years later on The Charm of the Highway Strip. That's like 3 years later or something like that. So he must have written that song. That was what I was trying to say about the early 90s. Everything was sort of mixed. Like, there was a lot of records in production. Steven had a lot of ideas in his mind, and he made like so many records in a row, and they all kind of came out like kind of mushed. So yeah, we made the Marvels of Insect Life single, but then also that very same song came out on a different album sung by him a couple of years later.
It's amazing how quickly you had that sound for this band. Like the Buffalo Rome show, obviously what you're doing now is much more developed, or what Magnetic Fields now is much more developed, but like it's there.
Sam is there playing the cello.
Yeah.
In 1988. Yeah. And he's still there playing the cello in 2024. It's totally insane. I think Sam is a huge part of the definition of that, because he had his cello the whole time. So, and I was a drummer until the late 90s. And then when 69 Low Songs came out, I switched to. And by the way, this is something you should just tack into the podcast, because this is a relevant statement. We've been talking a lot about genre. Obviously, the title of the podcast, Turned Out of Punk, right? It's about genre. Stephen, when he made 69 Love Songs, and I think I can say this safely on his behalf, he was trying to peel the onion of that on every level, right? Just like when he talks about Carole King, or he talks about the Fugs or anybody, he's just saying this is what Brian Eno would say, right? It's all apparatus around the composition that makes it the genre.
Mm-hmm. I 100% agree.
You absolutely agree, right? So there's 69 songs, and they're all him making fun of that point, right? Like he's saying, like, it could be country, it could be, you know, big band, it could be punk.
Yeah, because it's just a bunch of idiots on stage dancing around making noise until you imbue it with meaning. And that's what we're always doing, right? We're like, this is not just people making fools of themselves on stage. This is important because it has resonance and it
causes. But the genre too is the song itself is a composition that, generally speaking, is not its own genre. Like you can play a country song in a punk way, as we all know, because the punks took the 50s songs and made them punk. So I guess you're right. That I think the substance of this call has been about how punk isn't really about music. It's about this ethos, because actually the songs themselves could be done in any genre. That's like, I think, what I'm trying to say. So he's taking 69 Love Songs. He's making a point about that. He's saying, like, I can write a song in any genre. Like, it's not about I'm an indie guy, or I'm a blues guy, or I'm a R&B guy, or I'm a whatever guy. I'm just a songwriter. And here's a whole lot of different genres, including punk.
That's a perfect way to end it. But now to insert myself into it one more time. But like, I feel like that box set coming out, hearing that 99, as like a punk kid, like, and punk kid prior to that had been like, how real, like, quote unquote, real can you make this? How like stripped down, how like emotional. But hearing that, it gave permission for ambition in a way that you can make something like, why can't you make something like this? And obviously, right, songwriting skills and everything excluded, but like, why can't I do that too? And that's what I think that record, outside of the music on it, is so important, because it is like, ambition doesn't have to be the Beatles making the White Album. Ambition can be your band making something that you believe in.
That's awesome.
Well, this has been awesome, Claudia. And anytime you want to come back by yourself, or you want to come back, or if you want to come back with Steven, you are always welcome here.
Thank you so much. It's been so fun.
Told you this was a spicy one. Oh, I love it. I love this episode. Thank you very much, Stephen and Claudia. Claudia and Stephen, for coming on the show. You are both welcome back whenever you want. And we can do this again. I got more debate stuff to debate. Check out the episodes, though, with The Clean. Because that Flying Nun Records, 100% punk stuff. That's the thing. Don't let anyone define punk for you. Define it yourself, because everybody's somebody's poser. Everyone's got the wrong definition of this thing. And that's what makes it so perfect. All right, I could ramble on about the magnetic fields, and I could ramble on about punk forever, but I should not be doing that. I should be heading off to bed. But before I do, I got to tell you what's coming up on the next episode. The next episode will be Arthur Rizik. From Coal World, Iron Age, Power Trip, War Hungry, producer of countless records, master of countless records, just a musical genius, currently on tour with with Eternal Champion. If you've not heard this band, they are godly. Tarpey from Iron Age on vocals. Summerland, I believe, is on the tour as well. I think Arthur still plays in them too. I will have this all figured out for next episode. But in the meantime, check out the music of Arthur. Check out the music of the Magnetic Fields. And check out some of those Turned Out of Punk classics that are going up in the feed. There are some good episodes in those. Oh my gosh, some of my favorites. Going back and re-listening to that. All right, that's it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths, different identities, different races, different nationalities. Because we're not talking about politics. This is just human rights. Ceasefires. Permanent ceasefires. That's just basic human rights. People deserve to be able to live free from hate and violence and discrimination. So if there's organizations that are affecting positive change in your community, get involved. Donate your time, donate your money, whatever. I'm sure they could use that support. Speaking of using support, get involved in your local scene. Start a band. Start doing shows. Start making flyers. Start a podcast. Make a tape. Because this culture gets better when you contribute to it. And anyone can contribute to this thing. And that's the thing that makes punk great. Maybe not a podcast. There's enough of these. No, start a podcast. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. And they can perform miracles. I've seen it happen with my own eyes. And try meditating. It's something I got to do more often. And whenever I do, it feels amazing. It took me a long time to get to the stage, though, with it. And if you're finding it frustrating, just stick with it. If I can do it, I guarantee you can. And that is it. I don't think I got anything more. Oh, man. Voice is shredded. That's it for me.